From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Matt Fraction writes comic books and won the first ever Penn USA Literary Award for graphic novels. His comic collaborations and solo projects have won Eisners, Harveys, and Eagles, with his signature piece, Sex Criminals, winning Time Magazine's Best Comic of 2013. Other high-profile projects include Hawkeye, The Invincible Iron Man, The Mighty Thor, The Uncanny X-Men, and The Fantastic Four, among others. Matt Fraction will be speaking at the Columbus College of Art and Design on October 23rd as part of their Crafting Your Hustle series, which highlights artists and writers who make a living from their craft. More information is available at our website at craftheshow.com. Welcome to Craft, Matt Fraction.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going great, and we're looking forward to you coming to town to talk about how to craft your hustle. And let's start off with talking about your most widely, or I think one of your most recent works, the very widely praised Sex Criminals. How do you describe it to people who are coming to it fresh?
Oh, let's see. Well, first, I usually apologize. It's a dirty sex comedy.
Good.
It's a comedy. It's a love story. It's dirty, but funny dirty, not dirty dirty.
Right. So after you've apologized and, you know, not really backed away by saying it's funny dirty, but dirty dirty, the premise, as I understand it, is two people meet who have special abilities when they are romantically entangled, shall we say. And then hijinks ensue.
Sure. That's like the broadcast edit of Goodfellas version of this. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So what was the idea behind it? How did you get together with your fellow creator of the series, Chip Zdarsky?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the start of it, was Chip. I was wanting to work with Chip, who makes me laugh. Like very few things in this life make me laugh. And he and I had wanted to find something to do for a while, and had sort of just spent a couple of years sending terrible emails back and forth to each other with terrible suggestions in place. I wish I could remember what the kind of eureka moment when it all fell into place was, but I don't. Okay. I can point to sort of like antecedents, like I don't think that's the right word. I can point to things that I like. I don't know. It just sort of happened. And we actually ran the email that started the collaboration as one of our variant covers when we were out of ideas for what to put on a cover for like a reprint of one of the issues.
Okay.
It was sort of with wanting to work with Chip and wanting to do something funny.
Okay.
And sort of to do something that would take... You know, I'd spent a lot of time with the majority of my career focused, not all of it, but a lot of it on, you know, the world of mainstream North American comics, which means superheroes, you know, and Chip's style doesn't really lend itself to that. And it would seem silly to kind of like, well, I'm going to write Batman, but for Chip, it doesn't make sense. I wanted to write something that I, first off, just as a reader, wanted to see my friend draw. And he's so funny. I wanted to try to write something that was deliberately a comedy. Mm-hmm. I've written things where jokes kind of happen incidentally, but this is very much about the jokes, you know.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, maybe walk me a little bit about through that collaboration, because it's one of these things that I get to see from the outside, having done a lot of talking to writers and illustrators, that it seems like all sort of collaboration is a really unique thing, and people approach it and they've got so many different stories about it. So I'm curious about how you sit down to create with Chip. It sounds like it's probably over email a lot.
Yeah, and sometimes phone. We'll sort of have the, you know, what's the word? I guess... I'll have points. I don't quite know how I'm going to get from point A to point B, but I'll sort of cook it in my head for a while and figure out about what I think the shape of the issue is. I'll talk to Chip about it and kind of walk him through, and he'll give me thoughts, and I kind of go off understanding sort of where I'm starting and where I want to stop and what kind of about what 20 pages will hold. I have a pretty good sense of what makes up an issue, and I have a pretty good sense of when I'm short an ingredient, you know?
Right.
And then I write a full script, which is sort of very much like a screenplay. I break out, you know, the panel sizes. We work on an eight panel grid and sort of variants thereof. And I'll kind of thumbnail out the issue and write it and send it. And Chip then kind of pours himself into it. And he works all digital, so you know, there's no limit to how much he can kind of zoom in.
Right.
And he will just kind of we realized when we got started, and it became clear that it wasn't just dirty jokes, but that we were really kind of doing a romance comic. We realized a bunch of the jokes, like we're gonna have to do background jokes, you know, kind of in that very Mad Magazine style. Will Elder, one of the old EC artists and the guy who kind of gave Mad its soul, of that sort of like, we're gonna add a million jokes into every panel, just weird little details that have nothing to do with the story, used to call that chicken fat. Because it was the best tasting part of the soup that was the worst for you. So we sort of, when we got going and realized it was a very kind of emotionally raw story at some points, and a very kind of, there's really a love story, that the jokes were going to, a lot of the jokes were going to come from Chip being Chip, and kind of Chip's chicken fat, as it were, crammed in around the edges. And then Chip will send it to me, and I laugh at all the millions of things he's added, and then I'll kind of dial down the dialogue accordingly. You know, Chip gets to see all the really terrible drafts. Chip's, you know, there was a page at the end of issue 6 or 7 that's the final panel is like mostly silent, but Chip got the first version of it had, you know, 800 lines of dialogue in it, whereas basically it was just, there was no subtext. I was just writing text, you know?
Right.
A terribly embarrassing kind of things, but then I get the work and I realize, you know, when Chip sends me kind of the first, his when his work is done, I then kind of take another pass cutting things out because he's made it so unnecessary. But it's a very collaborative back and forth, where we both, I think, have learned how to play into one another's strengths pretty well.
Yeah, you know, one of the panels I saw that really stuck with me is it's when the two characters meet, I think, for the first time, and there's like a series of quotations from Lolita,
right?
And that made me laugh, and because I liked the way it was sort of spread out throughout the page, as though they're meeting at a party, and right. I guess he keeps running into her, maybe, or he's holding her attention by, you know, quotations from Lolita.
Right. She says it's her favorite book, and he does the opening. She was, you know, Lola in slacks, and, you know, a trip down the tongue to tap on the teeth at 3, Lolita, that whole kind of opening thing. That was a true story. I saw that. I saw that happen at a party.
Really?
Once. Yeah, there was a girl, a very lovely girl, who was sort of sitting, you know, in this chair, like she was a queen, like it was a throne, and guy after guy at the party kept trying to hit on her and kept trying to pick her up and like make small talk with her. And every time she just kept shooting people down one at a time. And some guy then was like, "Hey, so what's your favorite book?" And she said, "Lolita." And a buddy of mine who happened to be a Juilliard trained actor heard this. And he also happened to do an amazing James Mason impression. I don't even think he was necessarily trying to hit on her, but he then goes into the litany in his best Juilliard trained James Mason impression.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so she heard it, and she just, like, she got up out of her seat for the first time all night and just floated across the room and sat in his lap.
And that was the start of their relationship.
That's, you know, it struck me funny in a couple ways, because one was, you know, I really haven't seen, as a literature sort of major myself, I haven't seen literature work that effectively in those sorts of social situations, at least not for me. But
you're going to all the wrong parties.
Yeah, probably. The rest of it was to find a moment of commonality in Lolita suggests some very interesting characters. Not a lot of people will perhaps as readily admit to liking Lolita. I think it's a fantastic book. I was amazed when I read it, but I also learned that you're probably not supposed to say that so much in polite company on the people that know the story of Lolita. So hats off to you for for bringing that story out.
You know, I guess I also sort of feel some kind of kinship. You know, it's a book that's not really about what you think it's about, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an amazing book, but hard to explain, I think, to people who haven't yet read it and maybe been as floored as I was. One other question I had of her, one of the other things that you're working on right now is you've got an amazing number of projects on the front and back burners, and you're doing a thing called Family Freakout, which I think is a current.
No, there's a collection at Marvel. I wrote Fantastic Four, and then its sister book FF for a while a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay. All right, I got the publications date wrong. Sorry about that. But I was looking at it, and it was really interesting because you get to play with a lot of the ideas of what's going on with these characters and people related peripherally to it. Like you have the human, one of the characters claims to be the Human Torch from the future, and he's coming back to talk to some of the people, and he's not completely, you're not really sure how he is as a character because he may be mentally unstable, maybe he's not even the character. And I'm curious about how much leeway you get in a situation like that. If there's ever a time when somebody says, well, we don't really want the characters to be treated in such and such a way, or you just have a blank slate to do with what you will.
You know, when it's work for hire, there's always rules and parameters. And I think I did as well as I did in the work for hire game because I sort of just innately understood what was and wasn't appropriate. Mm-hmm. Everything was discussion worthy, and all kind of depended on your editor and where things were at that period in time. But now there was, you know, a pretty rigorous editorial process, and, you know, when I pitched the beginning of that story, I had the end as well, you know? So I was able to kind of pitch what I wanted to do. I was writing Fantastic Four at the same time where the actual Human Torch was appearing. And the two stories kind of started off together and then split off and then ended up together. So I was able to kind of paint the broad strokes of what the whole story was. And so while, yes, in this one issue, the Human Torch might be a crazy, one-eyed, you know, homeless person, they understood. I could tell my bosses, but, you know, in four issues we learn this, in five issues we learn that, and then at the end, X, Y, and Z happens. Mm-hmm. And kind of set up how it was all going to reconcile at the end. They were into it.
You've worked in a number of genres, Matt Fraction. You've worked in film, in comics. You've done some television writing. You're heavily followed on Twitter. What's your go-to kind of writing? What is it that if you had your druthers, you would do all day?
Probably comics, just because it's what I've done the most of, and it's so flexible and so... It doesn't involve the millions and millions of dollars. It's cool writing for television and movies and stuff, but, you know, there's anytime there's a comma in a check, you're going to have to answer questions to people who maybe don't have quality of writing at the forefront of their concerns. It's fun. It's really cool. And, you know, the thing about, like, writing for film or television is, you know, you write a whole lot less and you get paid a whole lot more, which is pretty cool, but... I love the immediacy and intimacy and velocity of comics where, you know, I can write something, Chip can draw it, and then 3 weeks later it's out in the world, you know?
Right.
And Chip and I are answerable only to ourselves. There's a tremendous amount of freedom, and we can do a whole lot. Comics are, in some ways, it's still a wide open artistic, it's still a wide open canvas, you know? We can still make up the rules, we can still, we're still kind of learning what formalism is. We're still kind of learning what our rules are. We're still kind of learning what comics can and can't do. It's so there's something incredibly pleasurable about that. That sort of being an explorer, feeling like you're a builder, you know, feeling like you're an explorer.
Right. That's a really interesting viewpoint because, you know, comics to me have been around for so long.
Sure.
That it's interesting that you say that there's a, that you're still learning the formalism, or that the industry itself is learning the formalism, the rules. I would have thought that you could say these are pretty well established. Although when I look at comics now, they're so totally different from when I read them.
Sure.
And I'm dating myself here back to the, you know, the X-Men in the 80s. And stuff like that. And, when you look back on them, they really do seem so much more formalized than they are now, so that it's sort of, less of a discovery of the formalism than it is you guys are really changing and altering so much of what could be done. Because I can't imagine in the 80s that somebody, could have done, something like Sex Criminals to have the mainstream success.
Sure,
because
sure.
The comic book shop guy's head would have blown off his body.
Yeah, you know, comics, you know, we self-lobotomized in the 50s because the government was trying to draw a link between juvenile delinquency and comic books, you know. So for a long time we were nothing but, you know, a children's kind of escapism. And it wasn't really until the 80s, with notable moments along the way, but it wasn't really until the 80s that comics started to kind of shake off those shackles and start to really kind of explore what it could do if it wanted to do more than tell stories about superheroes or whatever.
Right, when the Comics Code Authority thing disappeared off the upper left-hand side.
Yeah, well, you know, and just in the 80s, the what was called the direct market came into existence. You know, sort of comic book stores that did nothing but sell comic books, and you know, things just kind of changed. The medium changed and started to kind of get back to where it had been in the 50s, and start to kind of look for intelligent ways, interesting ways of telling stories that didn't necessarily involve, you know, costumes and superpowers and stuff. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, it was something. You know, there's an old adage or a metaphor, simile. My own terrible writer, I can't remember what these things are called. Where, you know, somebody said it would be like going, you know, to a bookstore and there's nothing but nurse novels. You know, so sort of there had been nothing but superhero comics for so very long. You know, we sort of forgot to learn how to do more.
Right. Well, Matt Fraction, I thank you very much for talking to me today. And again, we're looking forward to your speaking at the Columbus College of Art and Design on October 23rd. The information for that is on our website. And thank you very much and have a great day today.
My pleasure. See you soon.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.